22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, at least 13 people have died in anti-government protests in Iran.
Iran's cruel regime wastes tens of billions of dollars spreading hate. This money could have built schools and hospitals.
North Korea's leader says the U.S. needs to accept it as a nuclear power. Marijuana is now legal in the U.S. state of California. Also ahead, why breast ultrasounds can save women's lives. It's all on today's International Edition. Iranian state television says at least 13 people have been killed during anti-government protests, which erupted Thursday. President Hassan Rouhani warned security forces would respond to rioters and lawbreakers. Hundreds of demonstrators have been arrested since protests broke out over economic conditions and the government's military ventures in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and its battle with Saudi Arabia for influence in the region. President Donald Trump said in a New Year's Day tweet that it's, quote, time for a change in Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also spoke out.
Brave Iranians are pouring into the streets. They seek freedom. They seek justice. They seek the basic liberties that have been denied to them for decades.
In a speech to parliamentary leaders, Iran's president lashed out at foreign countries, including the U.S., Israel, and especially Saudi Arabia, for allegedly fomenting unrest in Iran. But Netanyahu rebuffed the comments.
This regime tries desperately to sow hate between us, but they won't succeed. And when this regime finally falls, and one day it will, Iranians and Israelis will be great friends once again. I wish the Iranian people success in their noble quest for freedom.
Joining us now is Australian National University scholar Amin Saikal. Tell us more about what these people are protesting about.
These uprisings have not necessarily have its roots in major political discontent with the political order, but rather with the lack of reforms and ramping opposition to ramping corruption in the country and the lowering of the standards of living for many Iranians. And also the ruling elite has been accused of accumulating wealth for their own benefit rather than really working for the Iranian people. And at the same time, I think there are many Iranians who become very much disillusioned with the regime's foreign policy behavior in the sense that Iran has been involved in a number of conflicts, either directly or indirectly, that is in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, and has been spending billions of dollars on maintaining this involvement in those countries. But of course, from the regime's perspective, the maintenance of a very close relationship with the Iraqi government, with the Syrian government, and with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and of course also supporting Houthis and so on in Yemen.
The foreign minister said that the protesters will pay a heavy price, but President Rouhani said people have a right to peacefully protest. Why the conflicting message?
The stratum is really divided between two main groups. So one is really the conservative group which controls the levers of power in the country. And the other one is the reformist group, which is headed by President Rouhani. But reform attempts of President Rouhani had been frustrated to a large extent by the opposition from the conservative forces in Iranian politics. So whereas the conservatives would like to see a suppression of these protests, President Rouhani, as somebody who has spoken against extremism, against terrorism, and to call for moderation, would like to see the demonstration taking place, but without necessarily undermining public order. So President Rouhani probably thinks that if the public are allowed to get rid of their frustration through these protests, then eventually the government might be able to sit down with some of the leaders of the protests and to try to come to some sort of accommodation as far as reforms are concerned. And that might really put pressure on the conservative forces to fall in line. But of course, this is something very complex, and the conservatives still are very powerful in Iranian politics, in Iranian economy, and of course, they also have the security forces under their control.
And you've got a younger generation now seeming to rise up, wanting something different. I can't imagine that if the sanctions are put back in place, and the president pulls out of the Iran nuclear deal, that will help them at all as far as the Iranians go?
No, that will certainly not help the Iranian reformist forces, and that will basically embolden the position of the conservative forces. They will turn around and tell President Rouhani and his colleagues that we had told you all along that you cannot trust the United States, and the United States is a hegemonic power, and therefore President Trump as basically wants to reinstate American hegemony and region. Therefore, Iran must pursue its policy of defiance and its policy of resistance, and that can only lead to more instability, not only in Iran, but also in the region.
All right, that's Australian National University scholar Amin Saikal. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Army says Israel has indicted a Palestinian teen who punched a soldier. The emergence of radical political groups is raising concerns in Pakistan. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's planned visit to Israel is up in the air again. And three big U.S. cities saw homicides decline last year. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, in a New Year's Day address, said the United States must accept that his country's nuclear program is a reality. He warned that he has a nuclear button on his desk and the entire U.S. mainland is within range. He vowed not to attack unless his country was threatened and struck a conciliatory tone with South Korea, suggesting he's open to dialogue and would even consider sending a team to the Winter Olympics being held in February there. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Evans Revere, a former Assistant Secretary of State for Asian and Pacific Affairs and president of the Korea Society, asking what this latest speech seems to stand out the most.
This is an interesting New Year's present from Kim Jong-un. My sense is that the more important thing here is the message of determination and defiance by Kim Jong-un. I looked at the message to South Korea as something that was largely tactical, quite frankly, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But I think the core message from Kim Jong-un is a message now from the very highest level of the DPRK of something that we've actually been hearing in other channels for quite some time, and that is that North Korea is and is going to remain a nuclear weapons power. And that is the reality that I think Kim Jong-un was referring to. We are what we are, and nothing is going to deter us from remaining a nuclear weapons power. And not only that, we intend to, I believe the word that he used was mass produce additional warheads and missiles to further strengthen their nuclear capability. To me, this is the most definitive, authoritative, and highest level affirmation of North Korea's intentions that we have ever heard.
Is there reason
right from the top?
Is there reason to believe them?
Well, there is reason to believe that they have a certain level of nuclear capability. My own view is that key elements of that capability have yet to be tested or have yet to be demonstrated. So I don't think it's true that they have the ability to target any place in the United States at this point. But the core message, I think, that I took away from this speech is that they are making and intend to continue to make additional strides towards the attainment of that goal.
There's an article in the New York Times on Monday saying that Kim's messages could be aimed at driving a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea. Do you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. And that's the tactical olive branch that I was suggesting earlier in our discussion. I think the goal here is to take advantage of a government of the left in Seoul that has traditionally been very eager to the idea of engagement with North Korea, that is keen to try to get dialogue with North Korea on track, and is also keen, obviously, to hold a very successful Winter Olympics. And with all of that in mind, I think the North Koreans are making an effort to insert themselves into this very elaborate and complicated picture in Northeast Asia in a new way by holding out the prospect of North Korean participation in the Olympics, which is something that Seoul has wanted to see happen, addressing a key ROK concern, which is to have a successful Olympics by wishing them well and holding it and suggesting that they might participate in it. What's, I think, important to keep in mind here, though, is that at some point in the coming days or weeks, North Korea will, in its own way, inevitably present Seoul with the bill for its participation and its goodwill in the Olympics. And that bill will almost certainly include things that Seoul will be reluctant or opposed to doing, including making political concessions and perhaps even making concessions in the area of sanctions. And I think therein lies North Korea's effort to try to drive a wedge between the United States and Seoul. Pyongyang, I think, is banking on South Korea's willingness to make certain concessions to North Korea that the United States has been unwilling to make. I doubt that Seoul is going to do that, but I suspect that that will be the essence of North Korea's approach as it deals with South Korea across the dialogue table in putting together the participation of a North Korean team.
That's Evans Revere, a former Assistant Secretary of State for Asian and Pacific Affairs and President of the Korea Society. The sale and recreational use of marijuana is now legal in California. At the stroke of midnight on New Year's Day, California became the sixth of 50 U.S. states, along with the nation's capital of Washington, D.C., to sanction pot use, even though the federal government still classifies its sale and possession as a criminal offense. Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and Nevada are the other U.S. states with regulated recreational marijuana sales. Andrew D'Angelo is the founder and general manager of Harborside Health Center in Oakland, California.
It's a pretty moving experience for folks that have been working on this for decades and decades and decades.
With marijuana legalization in California, home to 39 million people, more than one in five Americans now live in states where the drug is sold for general use and not just for medicinal purposes. Joshua Woodson is a customer who's pleased the law has taken effect.
It's a step in the right direction, I think. One of the things that we have to start thinking about is all the people who, you know, using before for the same reasons that, you know, they were using now and have find themselves under the arm of the law with in prison for doing something that was completely harmless. You got to think about taking steps to get them out and get them liberated, because now that we've all established that this harms no one, it's not a detriment to society. It's actually something that helps.
Well, joining us now to talk about this and how it's being implemented in California is Chris Lindsay, Senior Legislative Counsel for the Marijuana Policy Project. Chris, are California regulators ready for this big change?
Residents and those in California have actually had access, or they can legally possess, since they adopted the law through a voter initiative in November of 2016. What's changing on the first is that's when the first of the licensed businesses will start to come online that can actually legally sell to those individuals. So that's a big shift, but protections have been there for a little while.
Are they going to have retail stores, actually, where people can go in and buy marijuana?
Yeah, that's correct. That's really what is going to be most noticeable to, you know, your sort of average California consumer is, hey, now I can go to a store and make a purchase there. Now, question is, are they ready? Come Monday, I don't think we're going to see lots and lots and lots of these businesses up and running for a wide variety of reasons. But I think primarily it's because local communities are very much involved in this process. And, you know, they're all over the board. Some of them are embracing it and rushing to implement rules and license businesses. Others, you know, are going so far as saying, we don't want it here at all. and everything in between. And that all of that has to be sorted out for these businesses to be able to get the credentials needed to be up and running with state officials. It's a very much a moving target right now, and there are lots and lots of businesses working really hard to try to get open as early as they can.
Who will be able to buy it, and will they be able to smoke it in public?
They will be able to make purchases, anybody that's, you know, 21 or older. That's it. Just like going into a liquor store. So they, you know, they'll want to make sure that you're really of age. But, you know, we don't have a registry. There isn't something, you know, people have to sign up for in order to participate. They're not going to be able to consume it in public. There are going to be lots of rules about that. Local communities have their rules. At the state level, I don't believe there's any latitude for public consumption. You know, California is really kind of led a lot of the nation in terms of exposing people to smoke, and certainly that wouldn't be a component of this kind of law.
It would seem it's a pretty big change from a lightly regulated medical marijuana industry and, of course, the vast illegal markets going to legal marijuana economy. How will that work?
Well, the transition's going to take a while. And understand that it's not that it was a lightly regulated medical marijuana program. It was virtually unregulated, at least at the business level. Now, that's not to say that it was as crazy as maybe some would try to portray it, but we're really far from where California was just a couple of years ago. And so, you know, this is a reflection of how these laws have emerged on the scene and how they changed over time. And then California sort of came back around to revisit its rules fairly late in the game. And there were a lot of states that had kind of gotten innovative in many ways. So California was revisiting that in order to get its medical marijuana program kind of up to spec. And it was in the midst of that that suddenly the legalization voter initiative started to really be kind of dominate the discussion. So right about the time California was getting caught up on medical and getting that regulatory system in place that it really should have had, now all of a sudden it's dealing with full legalization for adults. And so it really jumped into the conversation and started to get its hands around regulations, but, you know, the challenge really just kept getting bigger. And so we're just about to see things, I think, take off. And I think they've done generally a good job. To be sure, there are groups that don't like parts of what's coming along, and I'm sure there are going to be a lot of growing pains. It's a big, big transition that the state's undergoing.
The Obama administration seemed to be more in line with the state law as it is now and loosening marijuana laws, but we have a new sheriff in town. We have Jeff Sessions at the helm of the Justice Department, and he is very much opposed to legalizing marijuana for anything, including medical. So how will the state fare under that situation?
Right. Well, consider that we really have a system of government in the U.S. that limits how far the federal government can really go under these circumstances. So, you know, you've got the federal government, it can decide what laws it wants in place. You've got the state government, which can also make decisions about the laws that it wants to adopt. And the federal government can't actually make the states adopt any particular laws at all. And so while Jeff Sessions may not like the fact that states have taken this path, they have. And there's very little that the federal government's going to be able to do to compel the state to basically re-implement prohibition.
All right, that's Chris Lindsey, Senior Legislative Counsel for the Marijuana Policy Project. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the Lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Early detection of breast cancer saves lives. Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women worldwide. And as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, scientists are working on finding new ways to detect breast cancer while they're studying existing screening methods to find out which is best.
During a mammogram, a technician takes an X-ray of a woman's breast. A radiologist then examines the image for tumors. Mammograms undoubtedly save lives. The number of deaths from breast cancer has fallen by 30% in the U.S. since mammography was introduced in the 1970s. That's because when cancer is found early, the chances of beating it are greater. Mammograms are the best screening tools available, but they aren't 100% accurate. A mammogram can look normal even when cancer is present, and it can look abnormal even though there's no cancer in the breast. Standard mammograms are two-dimensional, but for the 40 to 50% of women with dense breasts, both tumors and breast tissue can show up as white masses on 2D images. Three-dimensional mammograms show a more detailed view of the breast. Women with fibrous or dense breast may benefit from a 3D screening.
It might find disease that we need to find that two-dimensional does not. There are potential cons in that it has a higher cost, higher amount of radiation given every dose, every time a person has the test, as well as it may find a higher number of false positives.
Cost aside, one study involving 13 U.S. hospitals showed that three-dimensional mammograms picked up an additional 40% of invasive cancers. For an even better picture, a woman could have an automated whole-breast ultrasound.
This is a new screening technique. It helps detect additional breast cancers in females who have got dense breasts.
The whole-breast ultrasound doesn't use radiation, and it takes up to 5,000 images of the breast.
This tool does not replace the traditional mammogram. Mammograms are the gold standard for finding breast cancer. This helps the mammogram in those females who have got dense breasts.
Studies are underway to find out which techniques are the most effective. While North America, Western Europe, and Australia have the highest rates of breast cancer, the World Health Organization reports that almost 50% of the cases and nearly 60% of the deaths occur in less developed countries. If we could improve detection and treatment, at least 400,000 women's lives could be saved every year. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you someone who performs random acts of kindness for other people? A person walking in front of you drops a bag of groceries and its contents spill out everywhere. You instinctively stoop down and help the other gather up the dropped items. It's just a natural human impulse. New research from Duke University now suggests that we're not the only species that displays such altruistic behavior. It turns out bonobos, a group of primates from Africa's Congo Basin, will go out of their way to help strangers without being asked to do so. While studying bonobos who were born in the wild, the researchers found that the small apes will help another get food even when their efforts aren't reciprocated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, some made us dance and filled our hearts with music. Others made us dream with movies. While they're no longer with us, their work has touched many. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports on some of the people who left us in the U.S. and elsewhere in 2017.
In America, some say music icons such as Tom Petty and Chuck Berry captured their souls with songs. Petty was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with his band, The Heartbreakers, in 2002.
Thank the fans for such a wonderful life, and I thank God for all of it. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Berry was one of America's most influential musicians. As a singer, songwriter, and guitarist, he was a pioneer of rock and roll music.
Johnny B. Good!
Berry composed hits such as Johnny B. Good, Roll Over Beethoven, and Sweet Little 16, which have become some of America's most timeless songs.
Zbigniew Brzezinski.
As former President Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Polish-American diplomat helped topple economic barriers between the Soviet Union, China, and the West.
It will be a time which will demand the very best from us, not only intellectually, but morally.
The comedy world also lost some of its greatest icons this year. Don Rickles, known as Mr. Warmth because of his sarcastic wit, and comedic legend and civil rights activist, Dick Gregory. One of America's most beloved actresses, Mary Tyler Moore, and Roger Moore of 007 fame were also among the stars who died in 2017. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. We wish you a happy new year, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution establishes the federal court system, which makes up the judicial branch of the United States government. The judicial branch includes the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as lower federal courts, which are established by the Congress. The Supreme Court is usually understood to be the highest appellate court, but it does have the ability, granted to it by Article 3, to hear original first-time cases. Article 3 also grants Congress the ability to define federal crimes and to decide how transgressions against federal laws may be punished. In addition, Article 3 protects the right to trial by jury in all criminal cases and defines the crime of treason. Section 1 declares that the judicial power of the United States rests in federal courts, which have the authority to interpret and apply the law to any particular case. Federal courts also have the power to punish, sentence, and direct future action to resolve conflicts. The Constitution expressly outlines the federal judicial system. To enforce judicial decisions, the Constitution grants federal courts protection from contempt. In other words, anyone defying the court's authority, casting disrespect on a court, or impeding its ability to perform its functions may be immediately punished. Clause 2 of Section 2 specifies that the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction in cases involving ambassadors, ministers, and consuls. Indeed, federal courts are empowered by Article 3 to hear any case arising under the laws of the United States and its treaties. Cases dealing with international maritime law and conflicting land grants of different states, as well as cases in which the parties live in different states, or where one of the parties is a foreign state or the citizen of a foreign state. But the most important function of the federal courts is to check unconstitutional abuses of power by the president or by Congress. As Alexander Hamilton, one of the framers of the U.S. Constitution, put it, "The interpretation of the laws is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. A constitution is, in fact, and must be regarded by the judges as a fundamental law."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Thank you.
Washington, this is VOA News.